Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Peter Koklanis, Albert W. Newsom Distinguished Professor of History at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he also serves as the director of the recently established Global Research Institute. He'll speak on the topic, Would Slavery Have Survived Without the Civil War? Dr. Koklanis' remarks were given as the 2011 Winchell History Lecture presented by the Department of History at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, October 25, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce a speaker is John Grigg, Associate Professor of History at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
Our speaker tonight, Peter Koklanis, is the Albert R. Newsom Distinguished Professor of History at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's also the director of the Global Research Institution at UNC. He earned his BA from Drake University in Des Moines and his MA, MPhil, and PhD all from Columbia University, which is in New York, if you didn't know that. If I actually did his whole CV, it would take up twice as long as we have allotted for the lecture, so I will just give you some of the highlights. Amongst his multiple awards and fellowships includes the Sir Thomas Stafford Raffles Distinguished Fellowship at the National University of Singapore in 2005, and the Salomino Visiting Lectureship at Stonehill College in Massachusetts in February of 2010. He's published dozens of articles, essays, and editorials in publications as wide-ranging as the Wall Street Journal, the Chicago Tribune, the Raleigh News and Observer, Economics and Human Biology, which is something that's not at the top of one of my lists but sounds very impressive, Reviews in American History, the William & Mary Quarterly, the Journal of Southern History, and Business History Review. He's the author or editor of seven books, including Shadow of a Dream, Economic Life and Death in the South Carolina Lowcountry, which won the Allen Nevins Prize from the Society of American Historians, Time's Arrow, Time's Cycle, Globalization in Southeast Asia During the Longue Durée, and Home in the World, Perspectives on the Economic History of the American South. Tonight, Professor Koklanis will be speaking on the question of would slavery have survived without the Civil War? Please welcome Professor Peter Koklanis.
Good evening. It's a real pleasure to be here tonight. I'd like to thank John for the last 2 days. He has been extraordinarily gracious. I'd also like to thank Sharon Wood and everyone really at UNO that has made this whole visit a real pleasure, and it's an honor to be here with you tonight. As John said, I'm an economic historian, and this is a relatively small field, and not that many people even know what economic history is or what an economic historian is. And I heard a good definition one time, and it goes something like this. An economic historian is someone who loves numbers but lacked sufficient grace, charm, or wit to become an accountant. And I think that in some ways, I think captures me pretty well, at least. One word before I begin about the context for this talk. It started, the germ of this talk on would slavery have survived had the Civil War not intervened, was a public debate in South Carolina for South Carolina Educational Television about 2 years ago, and it was in a kind of formal debate format between me and Stanley Angerman. And some of you might know Stanley Angerman. He's a very eminent Pulitzer Prize-winning economic historian who teaches at Rochester and Harvard. And I won't tell you who won the debate. I shouldn't say that. It was a good debate. But since then, I've thought a little bit more about the topic and have decided to kind of formalize it a little bit into more of a paper rather than just a debate format. So here goes. I'm at that stage in life where I don't know if I don't see well with or without glasses, but at times I might put glasses on and sometimes I won't. So here goes. Although some obscurantist Southerners a century and a half after secession still believe slavery tangential, if not incidental, to the coming of the Civil War, almost all professional historians place the peculiar institution front and center. That said, even today, many questions relating to the economics of slavery on the eve of war are open to to debate. The lack of consensus is understandable, for the subject is as multifaceted as it is complex, and it is possible for scholars to mount and sustain robust arguments that are different, even antithetical. Nonetheless, slavery was so important to the South, an economic factor so central to slavery, that it behooves all students of Southern history, and I would argue American history, even in the early 21st century, closely to consider the material issues at hand in 1860 and 1861. First, however, a necessary disclaimer in this day and age. Let me state straight away that I well recognize the moral enormity that was slavery, and my comments here pertain only to the economic aspects of the so-called peculiar institution, and even delimited to the economic realm, should be seen as an attempt to analyze what was rather than what ought to have been. To use professional jargon, the analysis that follows is couched in the language of positive economics rather than normative economics, which distinction was made originally by John Maynard Keynes and more famously by his antithesis in theoretical orientation, Milton Friedman. Now, even trying to understand what was is an exacting task. For starters, there are all kinds of definitional concerns. If the past is a foreign country, as geographer David Lowenthal famously put it back in 1985, we visit the economic history of the antebellum South with a very restricted visa indeed. What South are we talking about? As William Frayling, among others, has told us, there were actually many Souths, and the importance of slavery differed dramatically across the region. There were parts of the region, East Tennessee, for example, where slavery was unimportant, and by the late antebellum period, its importance in much of the border states and the Upper South as a whole was on the wane. To be sure, slavery, and more to the point, plantation slavery, informed economic life in some parts of the Deep South, the South Carolina and Georgia Lowcountry, the sugar parishes of southern Louisiana, places such as Adams County, Mississippi, and Tensaw Parish, Louisiana, for example. But even in the Deep South, there were places such as northeastern Mississippi and the wiregrass area of South Georgia where slavery wasn't nearly so entrenched. Indeed, rice planters, and that, for that matter, rice producers of any sort, were distinct minorities, even in a quintessential plantation district such as the South Carolina Lowcountry in 1860. So examining the role of slavery in the antebellum South, as it were, is no simple thing. Nor do our definitional concerns and problems regarding the economic place of slavery in the U.S. South end with matters of geography. One always has to keep in mind, for example, that although slaves constituted somewhere between 35 and 40% of the South's population in 1860, three-quarters of free households held no slaves. That amongst those households that did hold slaves, only 15 to 20% held 20 or more slaves, the lower bound threshold for planter status, which means that planter households in the South as a whole constituted only somewhere between 3 and 5% of free households in the region. Moreover, the median number of slaves held in 1850 was somewhere between 4 and 6, and the modal number, that is to say the number of slaves the largest number of slaveholding households held, was, take a guess, 15, 10, 5? No, it's actually 1. Then there are definitional, not to say metaphysical, epistemological, and moral problems arising from attempts to nail down what we mean by people and what we mean by wealth in the antebellum South. That is to say, in our economic calculations, particularly those relating to per capita income and per capita wealth, how are slaves to be considered? Should slaves, 35 to 40% of the region's population, be considered part of the denominator, as it were, when dividing up the South's income or wealth on a per capita basis? The way in which we answer this question matters deeply, as does how we come down on the matter of including or excluding from our wealth calculations that proportion of the South's total wealth constituted by the value of slaves. With slaves, basically capitalized human beings, constituting almost 50% of the region's total wealth in 1860, whether we include or exclude this component matters a great deal, particularly in comparisons with free labor regions, where, as the classical economist John Stuart Mill famously pointed out long ago, the value of the labor force is not included in wealth calculations. So basically, if the Southern wealth is held 50% in slaves, if you subtract that, the South looks much, much poorer than if you include it. And for some purposes, it should be included because investment decisions are made on the basis of, you know, having that wealth in hand for all kinds of reasons. Now, definitional problems aside, other serious problems also arise when we attempt to analyze the economics of slavery. There are severe data limitations, for one thing. Quantitative data are widely scattered across space and through time, making interpolation, extrapolation, and out-and-out surmise necessary, however insufficient. Estimating matters such as labor productivity, let alone total factor productivity, and profitability, let alone economic viability, are difficult enough even today. So think about the difficulties trying to do so in another country, as it were, the past 150 years ago. Then there is the congeré of problems associated with interpretation and misinterpretation, problems of the sort brilliantly set forth 57 years ago by Daryl Huff in How to Lie with Statistics, the best-selling statistics book of the last half century. Such problems, as many have pointed out, have long bedeviled those that would enter the dense and thorny profitability of slavery thicket. To use a Huffian example, this one relating to the difference between so-called ROI, return on investment, and ROS, return on sales. Let me give you this little example because it's very illustrative. Pretend that an entrepreneur purchases a widget one day for 99 cents, which he or she then sells for a dollar later that same day. That same entrepreneur then reprises these same two transactions for the next 364 days. His or her rate of profit for the year, calculated on an ROI, return on investment, basis would be 365%, but on an ROS, return on sales basis, it would be 1%. This same type of problem, that is to say, employing the term profit in different ways, measuring different things, and often simply talking past one another, has rendered the debate over the economics of slavery a contact sport, to say the very least. Then there are the problems resulting from the growing imperial ambitions of economics as a discipline. Simply put, as economists incorporate more and more areas of human experience into their interpretive clutches, it has become increasingly difficult to establish the limits and bounds of the economics of slavery question, which many now view as virtually coterminous with slavery itself. Whereas at one time almost everyone conceded the material realm to economics, but cordoned off spiritual concerns, economists now make claims on such concerns as well, bringing the emotions, the psyche, and even the soul under the discipline's dominion. It is thus a long way from the ancient Greeks, whose original sense of economics concerned the rules, customs, and laws, and nomos of the house or household, oikos, to Nobelist Gary Becker, for whom the decision to bear children is interpretively akin to the decision to purchase a refrigerator or a car, to more recent writers who have written on the economics of attention, interpreted the rise of religion and the origin of fear in economic terms, and linked to economic variables, behavioral expressions ranging from sexual orientation to laughter to cruelty. Here, though, we'll limit our purview to two matters: slavery's profitability and its viability on the eve of the Civil War. And as we'll see, such a limitation still leaves our interpretive plates quite full. Whereas some economic questions relating to slavery remain open, the relative efficiency of the slave labor force, for example, the question of the profitability of slavery to individual slaveholders in the antebellum South, that is to say 1820 to 1860 or so, is more or less settled. If it was once common for scholars to argue either that slavery was unprofitable to slaveholders or that profitability was an incidental consideration to slaveholders who were said to be motivated primarily by other concerns, virtually all scholars of slavery now believe that slavery, broadly speaking, was profitable to slaveholders and that the behavior and values of slaveholders, by and large, were either animated by or at least consistent with and explicable via market logic, considerations relating to the so-called cash nexus, and bare-faced, even blunt, profit and loss concerns. And for forging, perhaps I should say forcing, the scholarly consensus on profitability that has emerged over the past 30 years or so, the aforementioned Stanley Angerman and his Nobelist colleague Robert Fogel deserve more credit than anyone else. Now, at the margin, there may be still some room for debate. I, for one, would argue that slave labor employed in the production of rice in the Low Country of South Carolina and Georgia was often unprofitable on the eve of the Civil War. And others would question whether slavery was still profitable in the Upper South at that time. While many, perhaps most economic historians would incorporate the decline of the Low Country and the withering of slavery in the Upper South into a broader narrative relating to the strong demand for labor in higher productivity settings in the emerging cotton belt in the old Southwest, Mississippi, Louisiana, places like that, it is not completely clear that the slave labor market in the South was fully integrated, even in 1860. Slave prices in the rice region were much lower than prices for slaves in the old Southwest, far lower than could be justified by the costs of transportation west. And many contemporaries commented on the reasons why. Rice slaves were often seen as overly specialized. They seldom knew how to plow. They were seen as too independent, accustomed as they were to the task system of labor organization rather than to the gang system, which was common in cotton. They were often viewed as damaged goods health-wise because of their years of mud work in the Low Country's malarial swamps. In other words, slave labor markets in coastal South Carolina and Georgia may have been somewhat distinct from the broader market for slaves in the South. And as a result, slaveholders in the Low Country may not have reaped the same level of capital gains as slaveholders did elsewhere in the region from the general appreciation of slave prices in the late antebellum period. Even so, it still needs to be pointed out that in the South as a whole, slave prices were high and rising in the middle of the 19th century, just as they were throughout the Western Hemisphere. Now, one can question whether such increases were evidence of efficient markets, or rather of what Alan Greenspan and later Robert Shiller have famously called irrational exuberance. But at the end of the day, it is fair to conclude that slavery was profitable to most individual slaveholders in most parts of the South in the antebellum period. More interesting questions quickly emerge, however, once we broaden and deepen our understanding of profitability by extending our level of analysis in various ways. For starters, we can change the level of scholarly refraction, as it were, and shift our attention from individual slaveholders to other groups and constellations. And perhaps more importantly, we could connect the profitability of slavery question to that of the peculiar institution's long-term economic viability in 1860 and to its long-term effects. Now, even after conceding that slavery was profitable to individual slaveholders in the South circa 1860, at least to those slaveholders not involved in the production of rice, it is not overly curmudgeonly to reiterate that only a quarter of free households in the South held slaves in 1860, and that only 3.5% to 5% of free households held 20 or more slaves. Nor is it all that unseemly to inquire whether slavery's profitability extended far beyond the slaveholders themselves. In this regard, it is clear, first of all, that the slaves themselves did not profit from the institution that bound them. Notwithstanding early 20th century cant about slavery being a so-called school for civilization, it is extremely hard to see how slaves benefited from their education therein. Moreover, it is difficult to argue that Africa benefited from slavery or the slave trade, however much individual African traders and middlemen may have done so. Indeed, recent work by economists such as Nathan Nunn and Warren Whatley, among others, has demonstrated with a good degree of rigor the myriad ways in which African economies and more broadly African societies as a whole were hurt by the trade that supplied slaves to America. In so doing, these scholars have corroborated less technical work along the same lines produced by earlier generations of African scholars. What about non-slaveholders in the South? Did they profit from slavery? In some ways, maybe, yes. Slaveholders paid most of the taxes in the antebellum South, for example. They were kind of the 1%, you know. And the economic lives of non-slaveholders often intersected and articulated with the economic lives of slaveholders in ways beneficial to the former. Non-slaveholders, for example, regularly sold provisions to slaveholders, sometimes did contract work for slaveholders, and often received discounted or even free services from slaveholders, cotton ginning, for example. Whether or not these bennies outweighed certain considerations we shall discuss momentarily when looking at the Southern economy as a whole is less certain. Two groups that did profit from slavery, undoubtedly, were European consumers and Northerners, or to be more precise, the populations in the free state of the United States. Both Europeans and Northern consumers benefited significantly whenever they consumed commodities and goods produced by Southern slaves, for some part of the surplus extracted from slave labor in the South was passed along to consumers in the form of cheaper foodstuffs, cheaper clothing, and the like. Northerners profited in other ways as well, most notably because their taxes were lower than they would have been without the income from tariffs collected on imported goods financed by exports of slave-produced cotton, tobacco, and rice. Slave-produced cotton constituted about 80% of American exports in the entire first half of the 19th century. So it seems then that in some ways at least, slavery was profitable on the eve of the Civil War. To inquire as to what such profitability was due, alas, is to enter yet another scholarly morass. The mind boggles, as General Alexander Haig used to say. Now, such an inquiry is a most important one, though, because the way one answers it can contribute to a sound assessment of slavery's long-term viability and its long-term effects on the South. For example, if one believes that the profitability of slavery to individual slaveholders was due mainly to productive efficiency, particularly via superior productive methods and scale and labor organization, one would likely argue that, economically speaking, slavery as a labor system was quite viable in 1860. The logical extension of this argument, moreover, is that such a productive labor system did not hold back the South's historic growth, economic trajectory, or long-term development. Factors other than slavery, or even the legacy of slavery in this view, explain the South's economic problems in the postbellum era, most notably, of course, the mother of all bella, the war between the states. If, on the other hand, one attributes the profitability of slavery in the antebellum South to other factors instead, to super exploitation in a Marxian sense, to a bundle of property rights embedded in chattel slavery that enabled slaveholders to overcome barriers impeding rivals employing free labor, to fortuitous market conditions for the South, particularly in completely integrated markets that reduce competition in some of the region's key staples, or according to a very provocative new argument, to biological innovations among innovating Southern planters that boosted overall agricultural productivity, slavery's viability can be questioned and its long-term effects decried. Complicating these questions further is the fact that we can never know for sure how long slavery would have remained viable in the South, because this mode of labor organization ended rather abruptly as a result of the Civil War. Nor can we use the cases of Cuba and Brazil, wherein slavery was abolished in 1886 and 1888, respectively, as so-called natural experiments regarding slavery's viability, because the international context regarding slavery changed dramatically with the abolition of slavery in the United States. Similarly, assessing slavery's long-term effects on the Southern economy is rendered extremely difficult because one somehow has to find a way to isolate the effects of slavery, qua slavery, on this economy from the effects caused by the destruction, devastation, and dislocations brought on by the Civil War, and the effects occasioned by post-war changes in supply and demand. Not to mention resisting more generic problems in argumentation resulting from the so-called post-hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy, after this, therefore, because of this, or arguing as though mere succession in time implies a causal relationship. That is to say, if someone went to Mickey D's and had two Egg McMuffins for breakfast, then aced a history test at 10 a.m. and then attributed the A on the history test to the Egg McMuffins, that's a post hoc fallacy, and this is done all the time in historical argumentation. All of which is a long way of saying that one should take the argument that follows, that is to say my argument that it will follow, for what it is, a serious attempt to assess the long-term impact, to gauge the long-term consequences of slavery for the Southern economy. This assessment was not made in a lab setting under controlled conditions, however. My petri dish comprises a large region, millions of people well over a century ago. In other words, caveat emptor, buyer beware. Now, this said, it seems to me possible, even likely, that slavery hindered the long-term development of the Southern economy. Just as slavery was somehow the cause of the Civil War, as Abraham Lincoln put it in the second inaugural in March of 1865, slavery was implicated somehow in impeding the South's long-term economic potential. The key word here, of course, is somehow, in a way or by a method not yet exactly or well known, stated, or understood. Because by the time of the war, slavery had insinuated itself into virtually every part of economic and social life in the region. As Gavin Wright has recently reminded us, in 1790, the North and the South were nearly equal in population, area, and levels of wealth. The Southern economy performed well by world standards over the next 70 years, but by many, though by no means all, important developmental indices, the North had moved well ahead of the South by 1860, and by 1900, the North's developmental lead was as enormous as it was unambiguous. By that time, the North was emerging as a center of world economic power, while the South, in a relative sense, had been rendered into a relative economic backwater status, with per capita income but half that of the U.S. as a whole. As suggested earlier, explaining why this great divergence came about is difficult, but let me lay out one plausible and hopefully persuasive scenario. Playing off of Churchill's famous comment in 1939 about attempting to analyze Soviet Russia's international behavior, the antebellum Southern economy is a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. To reduce the problem a bit, hopefully not to absurdity, how can I contend that slavery impeded the Southern economy when that economy was rationally organized, populated by a considerable number of impressive agricultural entrepreneurs, informed by institutions supportive of growth, extremely wealthy by world standards, characterized by impressive levels of manufacturing, relatively speaking, and growing rapidly? How indeed? How can I say this? By arguing, simply put, that the South's growth rates, impressive as they were due to a considerable degree to the labor exploitation and relaxed labor supply constraints made possible by the political economy of slavery, and to relatively fortuitous market circumstances, to wit, robust external demand for a few agricultural staples, for only one of which, cotton, the South had a distinct comparative advantage during the late antebellum period. By that time, Southern rice was being knocked out of the most important export markets. Southern burley tobacco faced formidable competition from better varieties widely grown both in the Old World and in the Western Hemisphere. Southern sugar, then as now, survived largely because of political protection in the form of heavy tariffs, import tariffs. It is not surprising, in light of the above, that the Southern economy, particularly that of the Lower South, lacked balance, so heavily dependent as it was on slave labor and a few agricultural staples. This economy was growing, I yield willingly on that point, but said growth was of the type that the great development economist Albert Hirschman once referred to as once overgrowth, leading not to increased sophistication, qualitative change, and a decisive shift toward higher order economic activities, but to what Hirschman aptly called non-cumulative development. Not to get teleological, but with or without a civil war, we find the South in 1860, a region with a large, poor, undereducated African-American population and a white population without much in the way of education either, certainly in comparison to the free states, where common schools were becoming, well, common. We find an extremely unequal rural wealth distribution, with the vast majority of Southern savings and investment going into the purchase of slaves, thereby crowding out other forms of investment, particularly physical capital, including improvements in land. Given such investment patterns, the South was the site of relatively low levels of inventive activity and technological innovation. While it is unfair and untrue to say that the South lacked cities or modern transport facilities, it is completely accurate to point out that the region's urban and transport systems were rudimentary in nature, with almost all Southern cities of note located on the periphery of the region, and the transport system serving in linear conveyor belt fashion to get agricultural produce as fast as possible from scattered production and collection sites in the interior to the coast. Unlike the case in the burgeoning Midwest, where robust linkages were developing between town and country, linkages that were even then creating the basis for the agro-industrial economy that fueled the region's dynamism for the next 125 years, the South possessed few interior towns of note. Indeed, if truth be told, interior towns were in a functional sense hardly even needed in the South. The Southern economy was externally oriented, to which the region's transport system and extremely high export-output ratio readily attests. Slavery functioned to keep the South's middle class small and its domestic market thin. As Robert Gallman and Ralph Anderson pointed out long ago, because slaves are more properly viewed as fixed capital rather than variable capital, it made economic sense to their owners to keep them busy all year round, which significantly reduced the need in the South for market transactions of any type, thereby limiting the possibility of forging organic links between town and country, between shop and field. Over time, such links, typified by the small-scale routine commercial interactions among farmers, manufacturers, and shopkeepers in the Midwest, concatenated, leading in the Midwest to what some development economists today refer to as ADLI, agricultural development-led industrialization. The lack of such links in the South, alas, led elsewhere to what might be called SLPTEP, the slavery-led path to economic perdition. To be sure, the antebellum Southern economy on the surface performed well according to a number of measures. And in some ways it is true, as James McPherson suggested in an important article in Civil War History, that really it's the North, with its precocious industrialization and modernization, that was the outlier in the antebellum period and that thus needs explaining, not the South, whose socioeconomic profile at the time was not all that dissimilar to a number of major European nation states. But at the end of the day, it still seems fair to remind us that no slave society in the Western Hemisphere ever developed after slavery's demise, whether said demise came via revolution, as in Saint-Domingue, through gradual emancipation, as in the British West Indies, Cuba, and Brazil, or via civil war. Rather, in all of these cases and others, slavery left a heavy, even oppressive burden on succeeding generations, leaving millions of people, ex-slaves and former slaveholders, blacks and whites alike, to endure decade after decade in pinched, if not desperate, material conditions, to brook myriad social pathologies, and to experience in all too many cases what can only be described as cultural despair. Income levels in the South in 1930, fully 70 years after the Civil War, were little more than half of the average for the U.S. as a whole. and slavery, Thomas Jefferson's terminable curse, and John C. Calhoun's perpetual blessing, was somehow the root cause. Now, none of this is to suggest that slavery would have collapsed in the South in 1861 or even in the 1860s in the absence of civil war. On the other hand, unlike Abraham Lincoln, among others, I don't think that in the absence of war-rooted emancipation, slavery would have lasted another 100 years. And in a number of his writings, Lincoln estimates 75 to 100 years of continued slavery in 1860. By 1861, slavery was dying out in the border states and in the Upper South. The slavery-based rice export complex in the Lowcountry of South Carolina and Georgia was increasingly uncompetitive. The slave-based sugar complex in the Old Southwest, particularly southern Louisiana, existed only because of tariff walls. The slave-based cotton economy was still dynamic, I readily concede. Indeed, the South became much more dependent on cotton after the Civil War than it ever was before the war, and production in the region did not peak until the late 1920s. But as the post-war history of the southern cotton industry demonstrates, production could continue to increase, even under more adverse market conditions, with alternative forms of agricultural and labor organization. And in my view, by the 1870s or the 1880s at the latest, southern slavery, in the absence of war, would have evolved into something else, something not very different from slavery, perhaps, but something else. To paraphrase T.S. Eliot, then, this is the way the world of slavery ends. This is the way the world of slavery ends. This is the way the world of slavery ends, not with a bang, but a whimper. Now, ironically, and alas, quite cynically, southern slaveholders, in retrospect, probably could have had their cake and eaten it too. With some cosmetic legal modifications in 1860 or 1861, one kind of freedom, as Ransom and Such famously put it in 1977, the South likely could have abandoned de jure and legal slavery, maintained a tightly controlled alternative system of labor organization, and for some time at least escaped much of the moral opprobrium emanating from the North. But the region's political class failed to grasp the insight Lampedusa articulated so well in The Leopard, his great novel about the collapse of the Sicilian aristocracy during the Risorgimento. As Tancredi, Prince Don Fabrizio's weak and ineffectual nephew, put it in the book, if we, meaning Sicily's landed aristocracy, want things to stay as they are, things will have to change. Thank you.
We do have time set aside for Q&A. We just ask that you would come up to the microphone here. You won't need to turn it on. Bob will take care of that if you need to adjust the site. So please feel free to ask questions, and we'll have some responses.
One thing that students sometimes ask when they hear this, or people in the audience, say, you know, how much did slaves cost? How much of an investment were they? And this is kind of important because when I said the modal number of slaves held was one and the median was 4 to 5, slaves were very, very expensive. It wasn't a trivial sum. In 1860, a prime hand, that is to say a male slave between about 18 and 30, went for about $1,800 in 1860 dollars, which is a little under $49,000 in 2010 dollars, using the consumer price index changes. And so, you know, it's a lot of money. If you have 10 slaves, you know, that's the equivalent of $500,000 today worth of capital on hand. And so it's a big deal. There were 3.5 million or 4 million slaves in the South, so you can see what a big investment it was. And when someone says that, you know, in the South you often hear, you know, we fought over states' rights, and as John put it today, yeah, it was the states' rights to hold slaves, basically. And it was a huge, half of the South's wealth was tied up in slaves in 1860, so it was a very big deal. And you know, these people went to the wall to save their capital.
I have a question It's hard for me to formulate it exactly because it was one of those moments where you said something that started me thinking, but I had to stop because I wanted to keep going with where you were going.
Oh.
You had referred to slaves as fixed capital,
mm-hmm.
So that it was essential for slave owners to keep them busy mm-hmm. all the time,
mm-hmm.
and that this hindered the development of local economies? Is that
yes.
what you were suggesting?
Yes.
Could you amplify that?
Yeah, I would. That's a good point. It's kind of tricky to grasp at first, but if you basically, you own the slave for 12 months of the year, and the growing season for a particular crop might be 5 months, but you're paying the upkeep of the slave for the other 7 months. So what you have to do is find ways to keep an enslaved person busy. So you say, well, you're going to also be a carpenter in the winter, or you are going to do any kind of a small task that in the north a person might go to a small merchant to acquire something or a shopkeeper to do. So what this means is that most of the internal economy of the South, the household economy, was very pronounced in the South, and there weren't a lot of commercial transactions. There wasn't much of a role for stores or little crossroads towns or anything like that, because almost all of the economic activity was done on site. Because if slaves had been wage laborers and said, you know, after the growing season, you know, their time is up, if you needed something done, you would, if you were the employer of the slave during the growing season, you would go to a shopkeeper or something and employ that person for blacksmithing services or iron foundry work or textiles or whatever the case might be. But because you own the slaves, you had to keep them busy. And in keeping them busy, that meant that you had the self-contained local household economies all over, unlike the North, where there were all kinds of these commercial transactions. If you look at a GIS map of the North in the middle of the 19th century, there are hundreds of little towns, thousands of them all over the place, and you don't see this. Even if you look at the bigger towns in the South, and I said that they're all in the periphery. If you have a little mental geography of the United States and you look at the South's biggest towns in 1860, you have some big cities. New Orleans has 160,000 people in 1860. It's the fifth largest city in the United States. But all of the South's towns are on the periphery. If you go from, if you include Baltimore as a southern town, you have Baltimore, Charleston, Savannah, Mobile, New Orleans. Then you go up the river and you have, depending on Memphis, Louisville, St. Louis. The only kind of interior town of any size is Richmond, and that's not very far from the coast. Atlanta is nothing at the time of the Civil War. Birmingham develops in the late 19th century. And it's because there was really no need for interior towns because the whole southern economy was export-oriented and looking outward. That's okay if the economy is doing well and you have robust demand for southern staples. But as there was in most of the antebellum period, but this was getting increasingly shaky in some of these staples by the end of the period, and when something happened to both slavery and the slowdown of demand for cotton in the late 19th century, the South was left with an extremely unbalanced economy that could not rapidly adjust, and they had all kinds of deficiencies in human capital because, you know, if you only needed unskilled agricultural labor, quote-unquote unskilled agricultural labor, you weren't going to invest in that population. The white population, people didn't invest in them either very much, and so you find hundreds of years after, really 150 years of deficiencies in human capital that are striking even today. One of the most interesting things, my research institute is putting out a report on November 17th on basically the problems of the southern economy in the age of globalization and compiling some of the data. You know, the poorest parts of the South today were the richest parts in 1860. It's the obverse. It's the plantation districts in the South that, because of the lack of investment and the path-dependent nature of the southern economy, history matters, and the fact that for 200 years prior to the Civil War, the South went down one path. It left it with few options, and even today the South is suffering 150 years after the end of the Civil War.
You've alluded to this, and I realize it's a terribly unfair question. Because I'm asking you essentially to layer several orders of magnitude of complexity onto an already impossibly complex equation. But it strikes me that in the late antebellum period, we're beginning to experience sequential accelerating revolutions in technology and communications. And there's a dimension there, certainly an economic dimension, that I'm wondering if you can explain or perhaps just speculate on that intersection. Because
that's an extremely interesting point. And I'll tell you, I've thought about this a lot, actually, because at the same time that we're coming to the end of the antebellum period and the Civil War, and much of the attention of both contemporaries and present-day students is on the coming of the war, there is more insidiously a business revolution going on in the United States that really starts maybe in the 1830s or 40s and ends up in the 1880s, where you see basically the creation of a national market and a whole different means and mode of business organization strategy and structure, the rise of big business, as it were. Now, it's and this happens largely, but not exclusively, in the North, but there are some manifestations of it in the South as well. Now, one of the interesting thing, and the great student of this is Alfred Chandler, of course, and Chandler points out that until about 1850, the biggest business units in the United States were antebellum plantations, the larger plantations, where as complicated, as structured, with as complex an administrative hierarchy as you'd find anywhere. But as the North was changing its economy, largely because with the creation of a national market via first the railroads and the telegraphs, you have new opportunities and new problems that have to be solved, and it ends up in a new mode of business organization. The South is left behind in that realm, and that hurts it again much later. In the South, I mean, for a long time, in the South, is really hurt because of what some economists call backwash effects. It has the misfortune of being adjacent to the most advanced economy in the world by 1900, which is the northern part of the United States, and it's basically an underdeveloped country that can't compete it's a late mover. And so when it does try to industrialize, it has to do things in low value-added, knockoff, mature industries, largely textiles and things like that. So the South's late industrialization hurts it as well. Now, where it gets really complicated is that if you look in a world historical context, the South is not doing that bad in 1860 in terms of industry. It's one of the larger textile producers in the world. Its per capita railroad mileage is pretty good. It only trails badly in iron production. So it's just that it has the misfortune of being next to the North, in the northeastern quadrant of the United States, basically north of the Ohio and east of the Mississippi, which is, you know, kind of a freakishly modernizing part of the world. But that also hurts the South forever. But you're absolutely right. With all the attention focused on the coming of the war, in some ways the more interesting phenomenon is the slow creation of a national economy that's emerging and is transforming everything in its wake. And that happens really straddling the war decades, you know, from the time that the first railroad, actually the first viable railroad in the United States is in the South, is from Charleston to Hamburg, which is near Augusta, Georgia. But the North has two-thirds of the railroad mileage in the United States by 1860, 20,000 of the 30,000 miles. And that advantage grows in the latter part of the century. That's a good question, though, and it's a good overlay, because the South's initial disadvantage gets even worse because of this transformation of business and the economy in the North. And the South it's kind of the disadvantage that Mexico argues that they have in much of the 20th century, being next to the United States, while the South is next to the North. And it's even more disadvantageous because it's part of the same country and it can't do something like devalue its currency to make its products cheaper or anything like that, you know, because it's part of the United States. So it doesn't have some of the macroeconomic advantages that an independent nation would have.
I'd be curious about your thoughts on the economic dimensions of the racism needed for the institution of chattel slavery. And I'm just curious what issues you would see and your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's a perennial argument that has been recently kind of revivified by in two works that have just come out in 2005 and again in 2008 by Eugene Genovese and Elizabeth Fox Genovese, who argued that the South was moving, by the late antebellum period, at least its ideological leaders, to the acceptance of a position of slavery in the abstract. That is to say that slavery was a preferable status for working classes regardless of race. And that they argue that many of the South's ideological leaders by the late antebellum period had come to the position that they were pro-slavery rather than pro-African-American slavery, because looking at what was happening to the working class in Manchester, England, or even in some of the textile manufactories in New England, that the slave status, economic status, was better, and certainly they were part of a more embedded community and not allowed, you know, suffer all the horrors of early capitalism. Now, I think there were some people who argued this way. I think Genovese and Fox Genovese overstate the degree to which this belief system held of slavery in the abstract. But I think it is fair to say that there was something beyond racism in the South that had people adhere, whites adhere to slavery. And in many ways, the South becomes more, quote-unquote, racist after slavery is over and ends than it was in the antebellum period. And sociologists have talked a lot about this. When you have an asymmetrical society, you don't mind physical propinquity, or, you know, you could live next to a person who is of a different color as long as the racial hierarchy is well defined. But when it is somewhat mixed up, then you start to exclude geographically and things like that. So you begin to get more kind of segregation and overt racist behavior in many ways after the Civil War than before, when things are a little bit more mixed up and then the status hierarchy is more confusing. But it's interesting point in the conflation of race and slavery in the Western Hemisphere, which is where it really becomes profound, because race and slavery were not always so much an identity prior to slavery in the Western Hemisphere, is a complicated issue. One thing to keep in mind, and people often don't realize this, that the whole Western Hemisphere was largely African in terms of Old World migration. As of 1820, 4 out of 5 migrants from Europe or America were Africans in the Western Hemisphere. So 80% of the people who migrated to the Western Hemisphere were Africans. And so it's a different world, especially in the Caribbean, Brazil. It's, you can't overstate that.
I believe you said at the beginning that you had a debate with Stanley Ingraham a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I hope this doesn't seem like an ungracious question at the start. You've been so persuasive. I'm curious what he said, what his side of the argument was, and then what did you say to convince him that he was wrong?
Oh, well, that's a good point. I'm friends with Ingraham. You know, some of you might not, he's the most gracious and honorable, decent economic historian in the country. I mean, that's not saying much. Most economic historians are not that nice. You know, it's a kind of vicious field, but he is not vicious, and he is a really gracious senior person. He's in his 70s, and I respect him a great deal. And he got to choose first the debate, so he chose the side that he is saying that slavery was very viable. And I think what he did is basically the points I conceded early, he emphasized. You know, he was saying, look, the South had a comparative advantage in these types of crops. They were economically rational, responding to market signals and signs, organizing production in such a way as to, make good profits for a long period of time. And the Southern economy, by world standards, was still doing pretty well. It was the fourth, if you abstracted the South from the rest of the United States, it was probably the fourth wealthiest place in the world in 1860, behind Great Britain, Switzerland, and Australia, and the North. Australia had just had this gold rush, and there weren't many people. He emphasized the short-term profit picture, and I more or less emphasized the long-term projection forward of what would have happened given what we know now. Any of you know Bum Phillips, the old, he was a football coach. He was in the 70s, and he once had a quote about Bear Bryant, and it was something like, he could take his and whip yarn and take yarn and whip his. And that's kind of how I feel about Stanley Angerman. You know, he could have picked either side and probably beaten me in this debate. But I'm not sure who won. They didn't have a show of hands in the audience or anything. But he's a formidable debater, and he's had, you know, he's been a monumental figure in the field. He wrote a book in 1974, co-authored with Robert Fogel, who later won the Nobel Prize in 1991, called Time on the Cross, a two-volume economic history of slavery that got good reviews at first but became a real lightning rod, and many people argued because they were arguing that, I mean, they went a little overboard in some cases, but they did, I think, show that slavery was, in a bookkeeping sense, quite profitable. But many people thought that they were justifying slavery and argued that slaves bought into the kind of rational system and profit-maximizing system and were kind of part of the system themselves. And they got in a lot of trouble, caught a lot of heat. But now he has survived that and is one of the most eminent senior figures in the field. Thanks, John.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Peter Coclanis, Albert W. Newsom Distinguished Professor of History at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he also serves as the director of the recently established Global Research Institute. He spoke on the topic, Would Slavery Have Survived Without the Civil War? Dr. Coclanis's remarks were given as the 2011 Winchell History Lecture, presented by the Department of History at the University of Nebraska at Omaha. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, October 25th, 2011, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Wendy Townley for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.